Now, this will be our second last study in the Acts of the Apostles. And we're going from chapter 27 into part of chapter 28 and verse 10. Let's ask some questions to begin with. First of all, why is it that Luke, who has spent some five chapters recording the trials of Paul, will now devote two more chapters to describing this extraordinary shipwreck that he encounters on his way to Rome? What's the point? What is it that Luke wants us to see? When we read of this particular venture, this voyage, it's fraught with problems. But we've also seen last week that the trials of Paul were fraught with problems, that there were groups of people determined to try and kill Paul. They made every attempt to kill him, but were unsuccessful. Now the next question is, can the natural disasters that we will read about here, as Paul makes his way from Jerusalem to Rome and encounters horrendous shipwreck and storm, will the forces of nature be able to defeat what these people couldn't do? In other words, will God's plans come to fruition? As we read this particular account, we're not reading simply an adventure story. Granted, it's filled with adventure, but it's not just an adventure story. The story really is about God, a God who's sovereign, a God who rules in all situations, a God whose will be done. It's about a God who wins. That's the main point of this chapter. Just as the trials of Paul was not to highlight the evil that existed, though it did that, the main point was to show that even where evil exists, God always triumphs over evil. Even when natural disasters are coming along, God will bring his purpose to completion. That's the main point that we'll be looking at here today. Let's begin here in chapter 27. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. We boarded a ship from Andromutum and about to sail for the ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. When Luke records the word, "we set sail for Italy," scholars are of the opinion, I think rightly so, that "we" here includes Luke. Luke was one of the people travelling with Paul on this particular journey. And people have said, the scholars who have studied this have said, that only somebody who was on board could have written such an account of the storm at sea. This is not something that you could tell somebody and then they write it down. What we will see is that the storm was just ferocious, yet Luke writes with such accuracy. He had to be there to have recorded it. We also find here that accompanying them was a brother from Thessalonica named Aristarchus. Well, we've read about him on two previous occasions that he accompanied Paul in his missionary journey. We also read about Julius, a centurion, a man belonging here to the imperial regiment. He's mentioned, I think, for two reasons. Number one, because of the high position that he held. But number two, because he was a man who showed extraordinary kindness towards the Apostle Paul. Julius, as we will see, was the right man in the right place at the right time. And I think this is something that we will see. We have seen it before in our study, particularly in some Old Testament accounts. Joseph, when he was in prison in Egypt, God brought him into favour with those who were his captors. The same with Daniel, when he was imprisoned, God brought him into favour with his captors. Likewise, God brings Paul into favour with those who are his captors. And Julius is the man here for the hour. In verses 4 to 8, we read here about the voyage itself. The next day, verse 4. From there we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed in Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving in Cnidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens, near the town of Lassi. So even as Paul begins his journey, it's a difficult journey. Difficult to make headways, winds are against them, storms are starting to blow. In verses 9 through 12, much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because it was now after the fast. Now the fast refers here to the Day of Atonement, which would have put this date in late October sometime. And so as they began their journey, Paul says a lot of time was lost. And now the journey had become dangerous because it was at a particular time of the year when storms are quite frequent in that part of the world. So Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be a disaster and to bring great loss to the ship and cargo and to our own lives also." But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and the owner of the ship. Since the harbour was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. There was a harbour in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. When you read the life of the Apostle Paul, you see that Paul travelled extensively by sea. So he was well accustomed to travelling by sea. And so what he has said here, that he warned them, and said, "I can see that this voyage is going to be a disaster. It'll suffer great loss for all of us." He was not saying that by some way of revelation from God. This is a man who is a seasoned traveller who knows something about weather patterns and that time of the year. This is not a good time to sail. That's what he's saying. If we set sail now, we're going to end up in trouble. We've already started our journey, haven't gone very far, and we've already lost an awful lot of time. And the weather is against us. And now you want to go all the way to Rome? Bad time of the year. Don't do this. But the majority decided, no, let's go ahead and make the journey. In verse 13, it says here, "When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they had obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete." Now, people here on board who had made the decision, etc., must have felt vindicated because suddenly the weather changes. And now they've got this gentle wind begins to blow. I thought, this is good, let's sail. But they were deceived. Simply because there was a little gap in the weather didn't mean that everything was going to change. It was still wrong time of the year to be sailing. So as they set sail, in verses 14 following, "Before very long, a wind of hurricane force, called a northeaster, swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind. So we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Fearing that we would run aground on the sandbars of Cyprus, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved." Now, the 7 points here that we just want to highlight here is that, first of all, as we look here about the storm, it says it was of hurricane force. Now, remember, they started out because there was a gentle wind blowing and they thought, we have favorable winds all the way. They were hardly into their journey and the weather changes and now they're facing a storm of hurricane force. When we watch the TV and we see places, particularly in the southern parts of the United States, hurricanes coming. You see how ferocious these hurricanes are. This is what they experienced. Secondly, the ship was being battered by the storm that they had to make it secure. Now, Luke doesn't give us a lot of details, but somehow they were able to almost tie the boat together. That's what they had to do to keep the thing from breaking asunder. Number three, it says that we took a violent battering. I don't know about you and sailing. I would not be a good sailor, not at all. And so to be at a sea, to be in a situation like this, would be quite frightening. And to be taken a violent battering. The fourth point is, they threw the cargo into the sea. And try to go back in your mind and imagine, as they before they left, they would have loaded on the cargo, no doubt a lot of useful stuff, precious cargo. But what use is precious cargo in a storm? You dump it, you get rid of it. And yet, great care would have been taken to make sure that that cargo is on board because it's heading up to Rome. But in the midst of a storm, you start to get rid of that which is of no use whatsoever. Five, it says here that the conditions were so bad they couldn't see the sun or the stars. They couldn't navigate. Sat-nav didn't exist. They had no way. They were just drifting aimlessly in the midst of a fog. Six, it says that the storm continued raging. So it's of hurricane force, it's violent, it's raging. And we're not surprised to read, finally, that they gave up all hope of being saved. This is one of utter hopelessness. And yet, it's in the midst of a situation like this that there's a word of hope from God. A word of hope in the midst of this terrible storm. 21. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have been spared yourself this damage and loss." Now, Paul is not saying, "I told you so." No, that's not his attitude. It's not one of those na-na-na-na-na attitudes. No. Paul, I think, is exerting here natural leadership. He's saying, listen, you need to listen up here. We didn't have to get into this mess. If you listened to what I said and just held off, we wouldn't be in this mess. And so as a leader, he told them, you've made a big mistake because you didn't listen. Now, having said that, he goes on to say, "But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'" I think it's interesting to give a breakdown here of what Paul said. I think it's reasonable to assume that the men here on this ship, about 270 of them, were all probably pagans, idolaters, certainly not believers in the one true God, the God of Israel, the God of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So what do you say in the midst of a terrible storm to people who have already given up hope of ever being saved? There's four things that stand out here. He says to them, first of all, God spoke to me. Number two, God told me what's going to happen. Number three, God stood beside me. And number four, what God says will come to pass. I think that's fabulous. A good theology lesson for people in the midst of a storm. They didn't need swimming lessons. They needed hope. And Paul was unashamed to say, let me tell you, I know things are terrible, but God spoke to me. God stood by me. God told me what's going to happen, and God will bring to pass what he said. What a fabulous testimony about God. I wonder, what do we say to people today in the storms that many people are facing? Do we talk to them about God? Do we speak confidently of God? Paul did, while the waves were lashing over the boat. And I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind, that when it says that the Lord stood by me, we find this appearing on other occasions in the life of the Apostle Paul. The Lord stood by him in the midst of his trials. But that's not an exclusively apostolic blessing. It's a blessing that God still gives to each one of us. In the Hebrew Epistle, chapter 13, the Lord there says, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you, so that we may boldly say, 'The Lord is my helper.' What shall I fear? What can man do to me?" The Lord will never leave us. He'll never forsake us. In other words, God will always stand by us. He's always there. No matter what's happening in our lives, God is there. Now, people may say, if God is with you, why is there a storm? Well, that's just the way things are. But in the midst of the storm, God is still there. In our lives, in the midst of whatever is going on, and some terrible things may be happening to you in your daily life, God is still with you. God is with you. Now, if you don't believe that, and if that is not true, we are wasting our time here this morning. It is utter nonsense to have gotten out of bed on a wet Sunday morning and assembled here. But God stands by us no matter what's going on. It may not look like that to us, but that doesn't mean God is not with us. "I will be with you always, even to the end of the age," says Jesus. He has not withdrawn that. That's still true. That's still true. Notice here in verse 27 following, they speak here about the shipwreck. "On the 14th night we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboats down into the sea, pretending that they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved.' So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away." He's saying, God said, everybody needs to stay on board. You cannot be losing good people whom you need to help with the sailing and to navigate and do the best you can to try and get this ship to safety. If there's people jumping overboard, that's bringing everybody else's life into danger. So everybody must stay on board. And so they cut and did away with the lifeboats. In verses 33 following, just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. "For the last 14 days," he says, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from your head." Again, you would know, you could well imagine being on a ship in these conditions. The last thing you need is food. The thought of eating is just, it's not on, but you know you're not going to be able to keep it down. But Paul encourages them, you need to eat to survive. And he says, that makes the comment, not one of you will lose a single hair from your head. Why? Because he has already said, the God who stood by me, who spoke to me, who told me what happened, will bring us safely to our destination. So do what I say. Get some food into you. Get strength. God is with us. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. I like the fact that when Paul was about to eat, he took time to thank God. And I think it's a good practice too.
You could say, yes, he said grace before meals. I think we need to be very grateful to God. And when we sit down to our meals, thank God for what we have. And Paul was unashamed to thank God. Now, I know you don't have to make an exhibition of yourself with things like this, but express gratitude to God that day by day he provides for us, he meets our needs, he feeds us. And that's what Paul did. He thanked Almighty God. Now, in verses 42 through 44, we find here that they hit a sandbar. I'll not read the account. They hit a sandbar, and some of the soldiers, fearing, the soldiers on board, fearing that some of the prisoners would escape. Once a prisoner escaped, the soldier would forfeit his own life for a prisoner who would escape. But again, it was the kindness of the centurion who stepped in here on this occasion and saved the life of the apostle Paul. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping, but the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plans. Did this man know that he was being a key player in God's plans? Not a clue, not an idea. Yet we saw in chapter 23, verse 11, God said to Paul in a dream, "You will testify about me in Rome." Again, he's repeated the same thing to him. Paul, you will testify about me in Rome. And so when soldiers were prepared to take Paul's life, the centurion stepped in and prevented them doing it. Did he realize that he was playing a major part in part of God's plans? No. But God always has had people in the right place at the right time. This is showing again the sovereignty of God, that God rules over all situations. It may look hopeless, but then God is bigger than hopelessness and steps in through this individual, and Paul's life is spared. In the next section here, they arrive on the island of Malta. We read the first these 10 verses. After 3 months, we put out to sea in a ship. Once safely on shore, we found out that the island was called Malta. The islanders showed us unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood and put it on the fire. A viper, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, "This man must be a murderer, for though he has escaped from the sea, justice will not allow him to live." But Paul shook the snake off into the sea and suffered no ill effects. The people expected him to swell up and suddenly fall down dead, but after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. In this account here, one of the things that I do like is when they have landed on the island of Malta, Paul gathers sticks and helps light a fire. And in doing that simple menial task, which I'll speak about in a little bit in more detail in a few moments, a viper locks onto his arm. The islanders watch this. And they say, this is a murderer who has escaped justice. And so they're standing back to see what's going to happen to him, and nothing happens. So they do a rethink and say, no, he's not a murderer, he must be a god. You know, wrong on both accounts. Wrong on both accounts. In 7 following, there was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island. He welcomed us to his home and for 3 days entertained us hospitably. His father was sick in bed, suffering from fever and dysentery. Paul went in to see him and after prayer placed his hand on him and healed him. When this had happened, the rest of the sick on the island came and were cured. They honored us in many ways, and when we were ready to sail, they furnished us with supplies we needed. What Paul did here was, again, a great source of blessing to the people. He brought healing into people's lives. And God worked in a wonderful way in his life that he was able to heal many people. Now, what are the practical things that we learn from all of this? There's four things that stand out in my mind from what we've read about this morning. Is that number one, that nothing will ever defeat the plans of God. Nothing. God has his plans and God will bring those plans to completion. He has to navigate his way in a sinful environment, in an evil world, in a hostile world. But God's plans will indeed come to pass. Everything that God said will come to pass. Everything he has said to us will come to pass. Now we may end up being in all sorts of storms and all sorts of calamities. But what God has said to us, what God has promised to us, will indeed come to pass. The second thing is that we need to be very careful how we interpret tragedies that befall some of God's people. None of us, no Christian, is immunized from tragedy in this life. Christians get the flu, Christians get cancer, Christians are killed in tragic accidents, Christians are murdered. None of us are immunized against tragedy in life. And we've got to always remember that we're living in a fallen world with the consequences of a fallen world. And what we have to be careful of is not to look at tragedy and say, well, that's the commentary on my spiritual life. That's just not true. Not necessarily. Was the tragedy that we read about here, Paul's storm, was that a commentary on his spiritual life? No, it was not. So we've got to be careful about putting a construction upon events that are simply not biblical. And I think here in Ireland we would tend to do that. Something bad happens to you. Ah, God is punishing you. And we kind of thrive a little bit on that type of mentality. It's unbiblical. It's unbiblical. Do you remember in John 9, the disciples said to Jesus, which man sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? So in other words, the man is blind. Now it's either he sinned or his parents sinned. But somebody's to blame for this. And Jesus says, wrong on all accounts. So we've got to be careful how we interpret tragedies in people's lives. The third point here is Paul's faith. Paul's faith in God provided hope for people in a hopeless situation. We saw that these people had given up hope of being saved. Not a chance of being saved. And yet into that hopeless situation, and it was a hopeless situation, Paul brought a message of hope. There is a God. There's a God who speaks. There is a God who knows the future. There's a God who will bring things to pass. That is a fabulous message to hear when the boat is sinking. That's what you need to hear. And that's what Paul was willing to share with these people. We need to have something to say to people today about God. In our uncertain world with so many things shaky, etc., etc., we need to speak hope to people who have lost a lot of hope, lost a lot of confidence in people, and their certainties are not as certain as they were 2, 3, 4 years ago. That's all gone very pear-shaped and gone very wobbly. But God is hope. We need to speak to people about God. And as these people looked at Paul, they saw here's a man with something to hold on to. When people look at us, when things are going wrong in our lives, what do they see? What message are we conveying to people? What is it that we're holding on to that causes them to stand back and have a level of admiration for what it is that you believe? We need to be like Paul and speak hope into so many hopeless situations. And we can never underestimate the power of a testimony like what Paul gave. It was probably not the most eloquent speech he ever made. I mean, standing on a rocky old boat and being blown all over the Adriatic, it's kind of hard to get your 3 points over. But he got the 3 points over, and I'm sure it had greatly affected the people, the 270 plus people on the ship. There's a wonderful story that John Wesley tells about himself when he made one of his missionary journeys to America 250 plus years ago. Crossing the Atlantic, again, a terrible storm broke out. I mean, they were fearing for their lives. But there was a group of Moravian brethren on the boat. And in the midst of all of the storms, these people engaged in singing hymns to God. The adults sang hymns to God. The children sang hymns to God. And he spoke to them. He said, are you not afraid of dying? He said, no. No, we're not afraid of dying. And it was their testimony, their witness that had a profound effect upon Wesley. He examined his own life to see himself that I really do not know the Lord. And he had not, at this point, come to truly know God, though he was engaged in mission work. But their Christian testimony had a profound effect upon John Wesley. You and I have opportunities from time to time to bear testimony to Almighty God. And the final thing here, go back to Paul gathering sticks. I don't know, I've always been greatly impressed with this. I've got great time for the person who will do the menial tasks. Everybody wants to be in the spotlight. How many are willing to gather sticks to light the fire? To me, see, I watch out for people like that. I try in my own life to be that type of person. God forgive me when I fail, and God knows I do fail. But everybody could have made an excuse. We're sick, we're 14 days at sea, shipwrecked, we're sick as dogs. Let somebody else do it. It has to be somebody else. Somebody here has to be good at lighting fires. And you can make a million excuses and do nothing with your life. Someone has to get up and do something. And that's what Paul did. He was as seasick as everybody else. He was as sick as they were. But he went out and he gathered a few sticks and got the fire going. And in doing that, then the viper latched onto him. Then the people are watching. What's going to happen? Then they conclude, the boy. This person is somebody special. And from that simple little incident, it opened up a whole opportunity for Paul to heal many people. Now, though evangelism is not specifically mentioned, you know, you've got to conclude that Paul shared the gospel with these people here in Malta. And so I think if you're prepared to do the menial tasks in daily life, the menial tasks, the things that nobody else is doing, but you see it needs to be done, go ahead and do it. And I think when that attitude is there, you're making yourself available to be used in a wonderful way by Almighty God. I think here in the island of Malta, because of Paul's just attention to small things, consideration, a bit of heat for other people, and I'm prepared to do that. God uses people like that. And I think God is still looking for people who are willing to pick up a few sticks and do small things. Do enough of small things and God can then trust you with the bigger things. But if you're not prepared to do the small things in life, God says, I cannot trust you with a big one. You won't even do the small ones. You know. So major on the small details and God will give you lots of opportunity to be a faithful servant to him.